This is Leonard Lofty Tyson, recorded at his home at Edenthorpe, near Doncaster, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 8th of December 2009. Lofty Tyson, Part 2.
What were the radio facilities like when you arrived at Sydney?
Well, they were the same as they were when I left, basically, except they were in a different hood. We had one main transmitter, two receivers, and basically that was it. We did have a standby suitcase transmitter receiver, which came in handy later on, but basically we just had the transmitter, which was a RCA Canadian built ex-Navy transmitter, and that's right, when I arrived I think we had two Marconi CR100 receivers, ex-Navy, and then we got two new Eddystone receivers, so we were all right, you know. At the time it was just about state of the art, but not the most up to date, but it was adequate equipment.
And you had to move all this, so I presume for a while you were off the air, were you?
No, I don't think we were off the air, because we moved between skeds. We had three skeds a day with Stanley Met to pass the Met Obs. That was in the morning. I can't remember now, I think it might have been 8 o'clock, 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock, something like that. Anyhow, that's basic. We had three a day with Met. Then after that, we had a sked with the control station, which in them days was Lockroy, which we passed any non-Met traffic through. And we listened to the broadcast from VPC, the government station in Stanley, to pick up any traffic for us. And the idea was we'd take what traffic was destined for us, and anything we missed, we got from the control station. But it worked pretty well. Then, of course, there was the scheme where everybody could send one letter a month. And how that worked, we sent it by Morse up to Stanley. It was copied there, sent to the office. They typed it on an air letter form and sent it off with a normal mail. Because in them days, communications with the Falklands relied on the Fitzroy going up to Montevideo once a month, taking mail, passengers, freight. And then every year there used to be charter boats coming out from UK to collect the wool that they used to bring stuff as well.
The wool? From the sheep.
Yeah, because in them days wool was the only export from the Falklands. In fact, the wool kept the place running. Mm. They were the basic skeds. So when there was a ship into Stanley with mail, we had the reverse procedure. The mail was taken to the FID's office, sent up to the wireless station, and then that was sent from the FID's office down to the bases. So that was all written out by the operator and passed to the addressee.
So the mail would arrive in on paper? It wouldn't be signalled, it wouldn't be Morse code?
Between Stanley and the bases, it was all Morse.
Oh, right, so the replies from the loved ones was by Morse?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was a combination. It'd be Morse between the bases and Stanley, and then on paper from there to UK and vice versa.
So you were receiving personal messages for other people?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, we knew everything that was going on, basically, because professional etiquette required that we kept quiet about some of it.
Yeah. Was it just a gentleman's agreement at that, or did you have to sign something?
Oh, no, that was all part of the job. Yeah. No, it was 100 words a month doesn't sound very much, but when you think that we're working at about 20 words a minute, and you've got 7 men on our base, divide 700 by 20, that's 35. Anyhow, it's a lot more than 35 minutes, isn't it? Mm. It takes quite a long time. And then, of course, the operators in Stanley were doing this for all the bases. And that's between their normal job as well, because they were working the bases. They were also collecting the Met Obs from South America. And the apprentices, well, and the operators there were also Met men in Stanley. So, you know, it amazed me when I was working there, because these operators, they could turn the volume up when they're reading the obs from South America and plot them straight onto the charts. It was amazing. And even the two apprentices were able to do that. But no, it's quite an eye opener.
Yes, you'd expect them to write it down first, wouldn't you? And then go to the charts.
That's... Yeah, well, of course, that's what I did when I was.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the normal procedure, to take it down on paper, but they could plot it straight away. Didn't normally do that. There's a Met man there to do that.
So when you were moving the station from the old hut to the new one.
Mm.
You had to move the aerials, the masts as well, I imagine.
No. The old masts were well past it.
Yeah.
Now, we put the new masts up before we moved down and got... Everything was ready, apart from the actual transmitters and receivers.
So the new masts arrived on the ship and you had to install them?
Yeah.
Mm. And this was a more than a one-man job?
Oh, yes, it was a full base job. Yeah. No, in Stanley, when I was putting masts up there, it was all right. We had a Land Rover and some flat ground, and two of us could put a mast up, no problem at all. But there, with it being uneven ground and no mechanical aids, it was a problem.
So it was all done by hand? No winches? Oh, yeah.
No, we didn't have any mechanical contrivances at all.
How did you choose where to put the mast? Was it critical?
No.
Or with anywhere to?
No, we just put them where it was convenient, basically. No, with HF, theoretically, the best propagation is at right angles to the aerial. But to do that, you need to have the aerials cut to the wavelength. Well, we were using such a variety of frequencies that was not a practical proposition. So we just used a long wire.
Hmm.
I think it's somewhere I should have photographs of it. It'll show you where we were. There's one in the front room. I'll show you afterwards.
And what was the coverage like? Were you able to pick up signals from across the world or just locally?
Well, it varied throughout the year. We used low frequencies at night during the winter and go higher frequencies during the summer and during the day. But basically, we were only operating between Sydney and Stanley and Graham Land, the other bases. ham radio was popular around the bases. Most of the other operators also did some ham operating, and they could work all over the world. But this is just picking the right frequency for the conditions.
Were you doing some of that as well?
I got a license on my way south, and I did operate for one night. There was some of the other bases were in regular contact with the UK and various places around the world. There was one particular operator in Chile who'd worked all the bases except Sydney, and a couple of the other operators got on to me to contact him. So one night I arranged out I would come up and have a word to him. I did make contact with him, and then the diesel mech switched the power off, so that was that. Because the power used to go off at 10 o'clock at night.
So you didn't bother otherwise? You didn't...
No, I was...
Feel the need?
No, I never had any desire to talk to anybody. Mm. I've never been a very talkative character. You've caught me... I'm a different man, talkative-wise, to what I was in them days. I never had much to say to anybody. I was very, not exactly shy, but I wasn't very sociable. So if I never spoke to anybody for weeks on end, it didn't worry me. Mm. Still doesn't. But once I start talking, I can't stop.
Keep going a bit longer.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any emergency calls to make?
Not exactly emergency calls, but we did have a generator failure, so we had no power. So then, so I had to get out the emergency set, which was operated on pedals, pedal power, a pedal generator. So I dragged this out and installed it in the wireless cabin, and I did manage to contact Stanley and the Lockroy, the control station, and we informed Stanley of the power situation, and I think we operated for 2 or 3 days like this. Then I decided that since the diesel mech didn't have any diesel engines to maintain, it'd be a good idea to let him do the pedalling. So I screwed the pedal generator on the floor behind the operator's chair and gave him a chair, and he did the pedalling while I did the key bashing, because bashing a key and pedalling at the same time is a bit tricky.
Yes.
But now the Virian Bay was the ship in Stanley at the time. It was a frigate, and that came down to bring spares, and the ship's electricians came and had the generators working in about an hour or so, and then we were back to normal.
But you didn't have 24-hour power, did you?
No. It used to go in for the radio skeds, basically, morning, afternoon and evening.
There's a very strange message in the files here about, if I can find it, from SecFIDS, which you may have received. This would be in October 55, about calling the Falklands.
Yeah,
remember this incident? They were concerned that there was a recurrence of insulting innuendos of such serious a nature as to render the originators, if discovered, liable to court action. And therefore they changed the rules, which meant you had to, if you wanted to send a request, record request to the BBC, you had to send it through Stanley first. Do you remember that incident?
Not specifically, no.
There were several malicious and even wounding references have been made, which have caused considerable distress to private individuals. And the people sending these have used false addresses. And they're trying to avert the possibility of the programme having to come to an end, calling the Falklands, because of irresponsible abuse.
Yeah. Well, that must have gone through the... That wasn't our base. We didn't send any to London.
Well, it's calling the Falklands, so I presume it was a record request programme, I guess.
Oh, yeah, calling the Falklands. No, that was a BBC programme, calling the Falklands from London.
Right.
That was, I can't remember, that was a fortnightly or monthly one. That was a request programme.
But somebody, it seems, had been sending in record requests of a rather naughty nature.
Yeah.
And that doesn't ring any bells with you?
No. No, the only problem I heard anything about, because I didn't read all the traffic going out from the bases, only the traffic coming to the bases.
Hmm.
There used to be an evening chat between bases.
The goon show.
Yeah. But... the governor used to listen in on this, and on one memorable occasion, he took umbrage at something had been said from one of the southern bases, and there was a naval officer involved, and the governor replied to he didn't reply. He sent a signal in reply to something he'd overheard on one of these goon show things, warning the man that if we heard much more of this sort of thing, he'd be chicken farming a lot earlier than he anticipated. Yeah.
Well, describe to me what the goon show was like. What came up in the goon show? What do people talk about?
Well, it was just... Anybody on the base would chat to anybody on any of the other bases if they wanted to, for all sorts of things. It might be to do with a job, or it might be just be normal social interchat. But we didn't go in for that very much on our base. It was mainly the sledging bases and the smaller bases. No, of course, if somebody had a birthday or something and there was a lot more than usual consumed, then, of course, it did get a bit crude at times. You'd be telling all the crude jokes you do. But, no.
This was voice work, not more.
Oh, yes.
Voice work, yeah.
Yeah. No, if there was, like, midwinter... That was a general get-together. Everybody was on the air and each base took it in turns to have a chat and singing ribald songs and so on. I never could sing, so I just left them to it.
Would they pass on advice as well sometimes, if somebody had a problem?
Oh, yes.
So it wasn't just fun and games?
Oh, no. No, if there was anything serious, because you made a specific appointment. Hmm. Like we had John Bull... Reckon he'd got appendicitis. So I got scared with Hope Bay. And we got the they had a doctor. And the base leader, Harry Dorman, had a chat to him about this. And he prescribed hot paling poultices. Dug out the hot kaolin poultice from the medical kit and applied it very hot, and that cured his appendicitis. Probably the quickest cure of appendicitis he'd ever heard of. But it was always possible to get a sked like that. Then, of course, if anything serious happened, like the end of the... Well, when the Biscope called first time, it picked up Harry Dolman and Ron Napier. that was a the two builders and took them to Admiralty Bay, where there was a new hut being built there. And then while they were there, I think it must have been a later visit to the Visco, the Fids going ashore in their base boat overturned alongside the ship, and Ron Napier vanished. So of course then we had to they had to have skeds with Stanley to report it, all that sort of thing. I mean, and later on, while I was in Stanley, there was a sledge party camping on the ice when the ice broke up overnight, and they vanished. So of course there was more special skeds for that. But between skeds, there's normally no traffic. But if there's anything cropped up, then on the next sked you got into touch with Stanley or the appropriate base and made arrangements to work them later.
So how did you fill the rest of your time then? Were you doing any skiing or any sledging?
I didn't do any serious skiing myself because my ski boots wouldn't fit in the skis. It was all right on the flat, I could wander around on them. But downhill, if first time we hit a bump, I'd lose a ski, and then I'd go down on the one until we hit another bump. Then I'd walk down to the bottom to collect my skis. So I didn't do that very often. But people used to go and ski, and I wasn't very energetic. I didn't want to go anywhere. I used to go down to Goerlee occasionally to see the penguins and take photographs and that sort of thing. And we all used to go out to collect seals occasionally for dog food. But I never did any sledging. They did do a bit of, once we'd got the base hut finished, during the winter they did do a bit of sledging with the dogs, just for training. And then I think a couple of them went over to Goerlee and camped over there for a few days with dogs and ran them out there. But no, that year we were not a sledging base.
Right.
We were basically building the new hut for the following year to take a larger party when they were going to be surveying Coronation Island. But
So you did spend the winter there?
Oh,
you did?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Were you happy to be on Signy?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, I think it was probably one of the happier bases. Some of the others were busier. Like Hope Bay was a big sledging base, and we had plenty to do with building the base out and getting it decorated once we'd moved in and finished. And I did all the wiring as well, which kept me occupied because it was lead-covered cable and it's a hell of a thing to work with. And we had two electrical systems. We had the 230-volt system, and then we had a 12-volt standby system. So we had a duplicate wiring system. And, of course, we didn't have any wiring diagrams to work to, so I devised the wiring at Signy, so I take full responsibility for that.
Was this lead cable difficult to work with?
Yeah, it is, because you've got to keep it straight and don't get any kinks in it. And that, I'd never worked with it before. So I've discovered that you also have to bond the two adjoining lead cables together, otherwise the slightest movement and you get crackling on the radio. Mm. That didn't come.
Were communications with Stanley reliable?
Usually, yes. Conditions were very variable. Some days it would be loud and clear, otherwise it was a struggle to hear them, and vice versa. But, you know, we had a variety of frequencies we could try to... We could usually establish reasonable communications. Mm. And, of course, you can get through on Morse when you count on RT.
So your year at Signal was coming to a close, and did you know what your next step was going to be? Did you know you were going to go back to Stanley?
Yes. While I was working in Stanley on the way south, you know, having got the equipment working there and talking to the controller, the chief forecaster there one day, I said, what you need here is a wireless operator mechanic who can do his stint on the keys and look after the gear. And he says, you've got some bloody good operators, but they don't have much of a clue on maintenance. So I never thought any more about it. And then, I think it was in August, there was a coded signal came in, and I was offered a job to take charge of the Fitz Wireless Station in Stanley. So I thought this was the job I'd suggested, so I accepted. So it wasn't until I got to Stanley that I discovered that it was a lot more than that. After I came up, my dad died, so I went home, and I went back out in September.
56?
Yeah.
To Stanley?
Yeah, I came home and then went back to Stanley on a 3-year contract.
And you had to start from scratch in Stanley or rebuild? What was the job?
Yeah, well, the job involved getting two old ex-Navy transmitters from the Naval Wireless Station at the end of the bay and installing them in an extension on the VPC government transmitting station, and then put in an assortment of aerials from them, and then moving the stuff from the Met Office into there. But all the stuff to do the installation didn't arrive until after Christmas, and it was due to start, I'm not sure, it was the 1st of May or 1st of June. And then when the new Bisco came out, she had water in the bottom holes, and the radio gear for some new bases was in there, so that was a write-off. Mm. So I got sent off on the new Bisco round the bases to see if I could scrounge enough radio equipment from the established bases to equip the new ones to get them on the air, because all the bases had sledge equipment, you know, battery operated radios and various standby radios at different stations. And so it was the end of February I got back. And that's right, okay. I was transferred to HMS Protector of Adelaide Island, and came back with that. And so when I came back, the building extension at VPC was almost finished. We didn't have any of the equipment to go. So I basically I had to start from scratch by bringing the transmitters up. And this was an 11 kilowatt transmitter and a 1.5 kilowatt transmitter, which the Canadian Marconi SWB811 and SWB8, if I remember correctly. And these were 1930s designs, so everything was big and high voltage.
But he worked, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so of course we had to dismantle them because they'd been unused for, well, since I think it was 46, so it was a long time. And then get them back and rewire them, tune them up, clean them up, and then try them and get them working. I spent hours polishing brass. And then we ran out miles of feeder cables to feed the transmitters. We put up I think we put up about 12 masts in here, from 60 foot to 30 foot, with a vast array of equipment. Mm.
And where could you reach from there, from Stanley? You could work the world from Stanley, could you?
Yeah, but of course this is a thing that unless you're in the business, you don't realise. You can work anywhere in the world when the conditions are right and you get the right frequency. Mm. It's basically a case of getting the right frequency to work between any two points. Mm. I got a good example of this. Let's see, this would be when the planes were coming out for the aerial survey.
The Kansos.
The Kansos, yeah. They came out, they were in Montevideo, and we had to pass them with weather forecasts. And they told us what frequency to use. So this was about 6 o'clock in the morning, so I was doing the operating because it was out of the hours for the operators. And I went up there and listened on this frequency. And I thought, you know, right from the start, this is far too high a frequency for this time of day. So listening, first of all, I could hear Newfoundland working. And then as the time passed on, I could hear stations further south in the States, Brazil, and finally I could hear Montevideo. Mm. But by that time, they'd packed up. It was about 9 o'clock. They'd given up. So we had to send a signal to them and get them to use lower frequencies, and we got through. But that was another thing. We worked them on the way down to pass the weather forecasts. And as you probably know, in Stanley, the weather changes very abruptly. And when they got halfway down and beyond the point of no return, the weather had deteriorated, but we didn't pass that on to them. So they found out for themselves when they came. And then this was the second year they'd been out. One of them landed up by the hangars where it was reasonably sheltered, but the other one landed down. Do you know Stanley at all?
No, go on, sorry.
Down at the other end of the bay, near the off the cemetery. So they had to taxi the length of the harbour with the water breaking over the cockpit and over the engines and everything. But what amazed us was the fact that the pilot who'd landed up that end had been down the previous year.
Really?
We'd have thought he'd have landed up the other end. But,
you were there for 4 years at Stanley?
Three and a half. I was on a 3-year contract, and then I extended it by 6 months, so that I got 2 summers on the trot instead of 2 winters.
Were you aware of any improvements in radio technology in that period? Was it a lot different when you left from when you started there?
Out there, no.
No.
No. No, because basically, key bashing, all you need is a transmitter and a key. But no, it doesn't.
Was it a prestigious type of job if you were a wireless operator? Were you kind of in the hierarchy of the island?
No. No, I was just another peasant. No, I set, all the time I was there, I set foot in the Colony Club on one occasion. That was when I came up from south. And I went along to the inaugural meeting of the cricket club.
Yes, I gather you were a founder member.
I was, yes. Yes. Yeah, I've never been... I've always been keen on cricket, but I've never been a good player. And when I was in the RAF, I never managed to get into a section team. I think the only time I played in the RAF was out in Rhodesia when the station workshops were a man short and I used to play for them. But in Stanley, you know, if I remember correctly, we had a total membership of about 36. And so we split it into three teams of 12, and we used to play 7-a-side between each other. And then there'd be odd occasions, like when there was a Fidge ship in, then we'd raise a Fidge team to play the FIC, or when the Navy had a ship in, then we'd play them.
What was the standard like?
Low.
And the pitch, was it a decent pitch?
Oh, we had a concrete pitch.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was on the football field, which I don't know whether you know it, but that's alongside Government House. I think it's been built up now, but the football pitch was there, and it was at an angle. And there was football pitch was at the top, and then the cricket pitch was below. And the grass was cut by cows. So there was a hazard in fielding. And we had this concrete pitch laid, and we had some other. There were one or two good players. We had a good fast bowler working in the Met office, and one of the FIC men was a good batsman. And we had quite a few are reasonable, but nothing up to even good clubs standing out here.
But it was doing it that mattered, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Civilization.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... The reason we played 7-a-side, because it wasn't always possible to get 11, because lots of the workers worked out in the camp. So if there weren't 11 people in camp, you couldn't raise a team. Mm. And, of course, there weren't many locals who played, but because it had never been played before, so one or two of them became quite good. We had one of them who was a good wicket keeper. He used to play in one of the local football teams as a goalkeeper, and he was a good wicket keeper as well.
Did you have a clubhouse?
Oh, no.
No.
No. No.
A couple of incidents, just to finish off with, if we may, Lofty. One was, I think you mentioned briefly about HMS Protector coming in, didn't you?
Yeah.
But they didn't all appreciate the penguin eggs you cooked for them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, when the naval ships came in, they usually used to invite the base members aboard for lunch. And I always volunteered to stay behind and look after the base. And the protector came in one day and invited us aboard. And I was duty cook, so I stayed behind. Mm. And the ship's boat came and collected the base staff and took them aboard. And while they were having lunch, a gale blew up. And so when the boat went out, or the boat had been tied off to... when it came to embarking the base staff onto the boat, Jim Shirtcliffe managed to get on, but then the captain decided it was too rough, and so he abandoned it, and the ship's boat came to shelter in the bay in front of the base while the protector put out to sea to ride out the storm. And there was a junior naval officer in charge of this lot, and to start with, they anchored out and came ashore in the base dinghy. But then they were getting soaked, this, so I decided that the best way was to anchor it there and just keep a visual watch from the base hut. And so we hung all sorts of bits of old scrap iron and that was lying around and anchored the thing out, and then they all came ashore. And they were under the impression that the protector didn't have enough fuel to stay for very long, and they were liable to be left with us, so they all volunteered for various jobs. And we managed to give them some dry clothing to wear, and they settled in. And I dished up some hard-boiled penguin eggs. And one bloke in particular wasn't going to eat this thing that, with a transparent white. So anyhow, for breakfast next morning, I scrambled the eggs and he still ate it and enjoyed it. But yeah, that led to another thing. The next day, they wanted to go, you know, we did the base chores between us. And then they wanted to go out and shoot something, so there's nothing much to shoot. So I said, what are you going to shoot? We shoot some penguins. You know, so you eat them or feed them to the dogs. So, of course, we laughed that out of ours, because if you want a penguin, you just walk up to it and clobber it. So anyhow, they went off. And after a while, I heard some shooting just outside the hut. So I came out to see what was happening, because we had some dogs and I didn't want them shooting dogs.
Yeah,
yeah. So there was a dead penguin near the jetty, and we got it covered with an openwork crate. And there were two skewers on the near side and one on the far side of this crate, sticking their heads through and having a bite of a seal. And then they'd come up to swallow it, and this is what they were shooting at. And I stood and watched and made rude remarks about naval marksmanship, with the inevitable consequence. One of them says, "Yeah, show us how." So while this conversation was going on, the two skewers at the near side had flown away, so all that was left was one at the far side. So when it stuck his head out next time, bang, and I hit it, much to everybody's amazement. So I said, "It's easy, isn't it?" Went off inside. Well, the consequence, as far as I was concerned, was when I got up to Stanley playing cricket, we were playing the protector, And the protector man was making out the team sheets, and we were giving him our names, and I said, Tyson. He looked at me, he said, were you at Signy? I said, yeah. I've been hearing about you. You're a dead shot, aren't you? Yeah. Yes.
What were the circumstances by which you left Stanley and left FIDS? Was it just the contract was up? Or?
No, the contract was up, yeah.
You didn't want to extend it?
Well, no, I mean, by the time my contract was up, I was getting on for 40. Mm. And I thought, well, if I'm going to make a career at all after FIDS, you know, basically it's the end of the road, right, radio. I mean, I'm so far out of date, I'll have trouble getting on with it, so I thought I'd better leave while I can. So I left. But, yeah.
And travel the world.
Yeah, basically. But before I left, in beginning of December, up till then I'd lived in Brecon's, which was a boarding house. And it had always been a transit place for transient FIDS. Only the Brecon's had left, and Mrs. Harris, Mrs. Brecon's sister, had been running it. Only she was taking over a new place because the Breckons were coming out. So I got my marching orders the beginning of December, and I was due to leave in March. So trying to find accommodation in Stanley at that time of year is very difficult because for Christmas all the people come in from the camp for the celebrations. So I went to... The FIDS were taking over an old army camp to house transient FIDS that year for some reason. So I went to see Johnny Green if I could stay there. So he gave it some thought and he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put you in charge. We've got a cook who'll do all the cooking and catering. And I'll give you 7 and 6 a day per head for all the FIDS up there. And you pay all the bills. And at the end of the month, any deficit you make up, and that's your end. So I says, right, fine. So I moved up to the camp. And then when the new lot came out, the ones who weren't going south first voyage were billeted up there, and they settled in very well and made friends with the locals, and they decided they'd put on a pantomime. And so they put on this pantomime. Now I was in charge, but that didn't make any difference. I was just one of the Herberts. And when they were rehearsing, I was banned from the camp, so it was a complete surprise to me. So anyhow, they invited, you know, locals. I think each of them was allowed to invite 2 people, and of course the FIDS office staff were invited, and so anyhow, this pantomime was a howling success. Literally howling. You couldn't, half the time you couldn't hear the script for the laughter. And the actors themselves half the time had to stop laughing before they could carry on. But this was a great success anyhow. So the following week, I think it was the following week, the locals who'd been guests decided they wanted to throw a return party. So we were all banned from the camp. while they took over and decorated it and got it organised. And we were all invited out to various locals for tea while it was all going on. It's all very friendly. So we had another good party. Then, of course, they left. And, of course, in due course, they were replaced by another batch of Fids on the way home. Mm. Well, they, of course, heard about these parties. So they wanted parties. So it became an established thing. I think we had parties every fortnight. Various topics. And for some reason or other, after this first one, I think this was when we had the pantomime, the police chief had heard about this party, and apparently he was sprouting in the colony club about this party we'd had, wild party we'd had there, and about half naked women wandering around the place. And fortunately, the coal sec was in there, and he'd been to the party, so I told him it was a load of bullshit. So, anyhow, after the next party, apparently he had another go. He said you'd have to get these parties stopped on the grounds that we didn't have enough toilet facilities, until somebody pointed out that we'd more toilet facilities there than they had in the town hall. And then his next do was that we didn't have fire facilities. Once again, we'd more fire appliances than they did in the town hall.
He was determined to stop you, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. And then after the last party there, some of the Fids took a couple of the office girls down the hill to the Bisco in the peat barrow, which was all right going downhill, but when they deposited their passengers and faced with a uphill push up to the camp, they decided this was too much, so they had a discussion what to do with this. So they hung it up from the whalebone arch alongside the cathedral. So they went back to camp at breakfast next morning. We were all sat round the table, mostly feeling much the worse for wear. And somebody mentioned this. So I said, bloody hell, the governor will be going to the cathedral for the service at 11 o'clock. We'd better see about getting it shifted. So I rung the police station and said, we've lost a peat barrow. Has any been reported lying around anywhere? So the man said, that'll be it. There's one hanging from the whalebone arch. So I said, where? He said, it's hanging on the whalebone arch. So bloody hell, we better get that back. So the people who'd hung it up went down to and got it back. But we heard later what had happened was the governor had arrived, saw this wheelbarrow hanging from the whalebone arch, turned to the chief of police. What's that doing hanging on the whalebone arch? I don't know, sir. You better get it down, hadn't you? So he turns to the sergeant and said, better get that down. Who turns to a constable and says, go and shift it. So by the time our Herberts got down there, it was down. But it broke one of the handles because all he'd done was cut the rope. Mm. Oh, when they'd gone to put it up there, they'd found a convenient ladder leaning against the cathedral and some rope. So they'd just done it the easy way. Anyhow, they got it back up there. And over the next day or so, they replaced the handle and painted the barrow. And so the the caretaker who owned the barrow was quite happy with this. So when the police chief started making inquiries about who'd only took the, he was convinced it was somebody off the Biscay. So I think he interviewed all the ship's officers. I don't know about the Fids, but I know he made inquiries there. But he never came anywhere near the camp or even rang. And I think everybody in Stanley except him knew what had happened. But
were they happy? Is it a happy time down there?
Oh, very happy. Yeah.
Some people say that their time in the Antarctic is the best time of their life.
Yeah.
Is that true? Because think... you did travel the world a great deal afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
And you never found anywhere to match it?
Well, it's different. I mean, it's unique. No, I think most people who were down there will regard it as the most interesting year of their lives. But, no, it was... And I enjoyed Stanley as well. As I said, setting up the wireless station, I was overworked and I was fed up because none of the operators had been anywhere near to see what was being done for them. So the complete disinterest. And so when we handed over, I'd got everything ready correct, but I had to move the receivers over before we could start. And the last sked at the Met office was 11 o'clock at night. We were due to start operating from the other one at midnight. So I went and shifted it over and then had to stay and show the operator how things worked, how to tune the transmitters. And then we had a frequency change, so I think I stayed over there all night, you know, just to brief him on what went on. And then, as I say, I resigned, but was talked out of it when I discovered I had to find my own way out. And I'd been flown out first class Air France to Montevideo, and then went down from Montevideo to Stanley in a Stoker P.O.'s mess on a frigate, and I didn't have enough money to pay me fare back.
End your 3.5 years of Stanley.
So I stayed, yeah.
We must stop there, but thank you very much.
I'm sorry.
I apologise, it's been fascinating.
I've rambled on for far longer than anticipated.
It's fine, don't worry about the thing. Thank you very much, Lofty, thank you.
Yeah.